This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm real pleased to have in the studio with me Susan Saldoff, the producer and director of a great new and award-winning documentary called Hot Coffee. Susan Saldoff, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you so much.
Well, how'd you get interested in this story?
Well, I practiced law for 25 years, and I knew that most people had it absolutely wrong about the civil justice system, that they believed that the system was broken and that that it needed to be reformed, which, of course, most people think reform is a good thing until it affects them personally, and then they realize they've essentially given up their own rights. And I knew that there had been this public relations campaign that had been paid for by large corporate interest to convince the public to give up their rights. Because if people don't have access to the court system, then they can't hold wrongdoers accountable, and then corporations get to make more money. And I was just fed up. You know, it's like one of those things where you're like waiting for somebody else to do something and nobody else does. And finally, I just said, you know what? I guess it's me. So my production company is actually called If Not Now Productions.
So you were a lawyer for a long time and you just had the chutzpah to say, well, I can make a film. That's kind of a big jump. What did that jump feel like?
You know, my daughter, who was in high school at the time, she said to me, who do you think you are to make a film? And I said, I don't know. Who do I think I'm not? I mean, like, why can't I do it? And I didn't have any experience doing it, but I knew how to try cases. I knew how to tell stories by being a lawyer in the courtroom. And so what I decided to do was to make this film the way I would try a case. So the characters in the film are similar to the clients that I had. The experts in the film are not dissimilar to experts that I would put on in a trial. And the archival footage in the film is similar to exhibits that I would use at trial. So I just took what I knew and I put it into filmmaking. I had to hire expert film people who knew like cameras and lighting and audio. I didn't know that stuff. In fact, the first day that I was shooting, I put on my Facebook page, do people really say that's a wrap? You know, I felt like I was playing director at the beginning, but I've come to learn every aspect of making a film.
And was it fun?
It was more than fun. People ask me all the time, are you going to go back to practicing law? And I say, only if I absolutely have to.
So the story starts with the case of this woman who became infamous around the country for suing McDonald's and getting almost $3 million because she spilled coffee on her lap. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so what you just described, of course, are the myths. It's what was repeated over and over again to convince the public that this was a ridiculous lawsuit. And isn't it amazing how everybody knows this lawsuit, or at least they think they do? And then they see the film and they go, wait a second, how come I didn't know that? So Stella Liebeck was 79 years old. She was a conservative woman, had never brought a lawsuit before in her life. She had worked up until about a week before this happened. She was a passenger in a parked car. She was not driving, despite the fact that Jane Pauley, who was substituting for Tom Brokaw on the NBC Nightly News the night of the verdict, reported to the world that this woman spilled coffee while driving, which is absolutely inaccurate. She was in a parked car. Her grandson was driving. She wanted to get coffee through the drive-thru. It was one of those old-fashioned styrofoam cups, because this was in 1992. The kind with that flat plastic top that nobody could ever get the little triangular thing off. So she asked for cream and sugar. They put it in the bag. They pulled her into a parking spot, and she wanted to put cream and sugar in. There were no cup holders in this car. It was an old-fashioned car. So she put it between her legs and steadied it on the seat. And it was a bucket seat. And when she went to pull up the top, she couldn't get it off. So she took the top off, and the cup literally collapsed. The coffee pooled in her crotch. The coffee was between 180 and 190 degrees. And the reason that I know that is because McDonald's had a policy, a manual, that required their franchises to keep the coffee between 180 and 190 degrees. That coffee, they knew, would cause third-degree burns, which are the worst kind of burns you can possibly get, within 3 to 7 seconds. And the quality assurance representative, who you saw in the film, he testified at trial, you can't drink coffee at that temperature. You will get burned. So McDonald's knew this. They had paid out over 700 other times for people who had been burned by coffee. And all Mrs. Liebeck asked for, first of all, she had to have skin grafting. She had to have skin taken from her thighs and sewn into her private parts because her skin was burned so severely.
I'm speaking with Susan Saldoff. She is the producer and director of this movie called Hot Coffee, and I just watched it last night. I got an early screener on it on DVD, and I've got to say the photos of those injuries were what took my breath away.
Yeah. There's an audible gasp in the room when you show this to an audience. No one's ever really seen those photographs, and no one believes how serious. I mean, they're like some of the worst burns you can ever imagine. And she was, not only did she have to have surgery, but she was incapacitated. She was in the hospital for 8 days, but she was incapacitated for almost 2 years. And all she asked for was the difference between what Medicare paid and what her medical bills were.
Well, you're an attorney. Why wouldn't McDonald's just pay that and make this thing go away?
Good question. I think that they just, you know, didn't want to create a precedent. But I'm not really sure the answer because they had paid out other people for burns. She asked for $10,000 initially, and they offered her $800, never offered her another penny other than that. And by the way, it's important for people to know, the jury did find her at fault. They found her 20% at fault because she had spilled the coffee on herself. But they found McDonald's 80% at fault because they had such a long history of people being burned and knowing that people were burned and didn't do anything about it. And the verdict, which was her compensatory damages, which are basically her medical bills and her pain and suffering, was $160,000. But the jury awarded $2.7 million for punitive damages. Now, punitive damages are very rare, but they're awarded when the court wants to send a message for bad behavior. The verdict of $2.7 million, which sounds like a lot, was 2 days of coffee sales for McDonald's. And then after that verdict, the judge on his own reduced the verdict to $480,000, which was three times the compensatory damages. And you might ask, well, why did he do that? Because nobody asked him to do it, by the way.
What's the answer?
Politically, what was happening at the time was President Clinton was in office. This was in 1994. Congress flipped Republican in the midterm elections, and Newt Gingrich became the first Republican Speaker of the House in 40 years. And he had his contract with America. And in his contract with America was tort reform or legal reform. And he asked in that legislation was to cap punitive damages at three times the compensatories. And that's what this judge did. And then, of course, they wound up settling after that for an undisclosed amount. But Mrs. Liebeck had to sign a gag order, couldn't speak about it, whereas McDonald's didn't have to do that.
And so you get the story from her daughters, largely. And also you interview the jurors. The jurors were great on this. Were people, the jurors, perfectly willing to talk, or did you have to twist their arm?
Well, first of all, I went to Albuquerque cold when I, not knowing any of these people and not knowing if any of them would talk to me. And the way that I even found the jurors was that I got a copy of the transcript of the trial, and then I had to see what their names were, and then I had to find them. Nobody wanted to talk to me. Who are you, and why are you doing this? And we were ridiculed. We were already made fun of. Why do you want to bring this up after all these years? And I said, you know what? I just want to get the truth out. After all these years, people still don't know the truth. And so I eventually convinced two of them to talk to me, and they're in the film, and they're fabulous. They tell the truth. But it was a unanimous verdict.
Speaking with Susan Saldoff, producer and director of this great new documentary, which won in awards across the country, it's called Hot Coffee. It's not just about this case, but let's wrap up this case by just telling us whatever happened to Stella Liebeck.
Yeah, so Stella, as I said, was incapacitated for 2 years after this event, and she passed away at the age of 91. She was 79 at the time, but she really never regained her health after this. And she was ridiculed. She was embarrassed and ridiculed, as people know, by this story. Her family, they've been involved. They were also very hesitant to even talk to me about this. They didn't want to get involved either. They had been, one of the daughters had been on the John Stossel show, and he made total fun of them. And she was like, who are you? And really, really worried that I was going to do the same.
He would make fun of them.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, now they finally feel like, you know, that the truth has come out, and they feel so wonderful and grateful to the film and to me for getting the truth out finally.
It was one of the daughters is a nurse too, so that those injuries must have really struck her as just how grave they were.
Yeah.
There's another case you deal with, and this is the case of a of Colin Gurley, if I'm pronouncing that
Gourley.
Right. Gourley. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so what I wanted to show, the first part of the movie about the McDonald's case was really about the public relations campaign, you know, and how that case was used as the poster child for what's wrong with our civil justice system. But then I wanted to show, well, what happened? Like, how did, you know, once the public was convinced that the system was broken, then they were willing to vote either for legislators who wanted tort reform when, as you know from the movie, most people don't know what a tort is, let alone know what tort reform is, and yet we're being asked to vote on these issues in every election. I think that, you know, around the country, these measures are coming up in every state legislature. Rick Perry has made tort reform one of his top four issues in his presidential campaign.
So what is tort reform?
Tort reform is essentially limits on people's access to the court system. There are all the different ways that people are essentially obstacles that are put in front of people so that they can't access the court system, or when they do access the court system, there are limitations on what they can get. So one of the major ways that that happens is through caps on damages. It's a piece of legislation that is a one-size-fits-all amount of money that these legislators in you know, the capital of your state comes up with that says in every case, no matter how bad the injury is, no matter what the negligence is, there's a maximum amount of money that the plaintiff can get for some. Most of the time it's pain and suffering, but sometimes it's for the entire verdict. And so I wanted to show what that meant to a real family. And I had heard about this family in Omaha, Nebraska, where the family had identical twin boys. And there was a birth injury, and one of the boys has cerebral palsy, severe brain damage, and the other one is perfectly healthy. And they were about to celebrate their 16th birthdays, and I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to go back and see how their lives are different at 16 years old and what's happened to them and how CAPS had affected this family up till this point in time. So I went to Omaha, Nebraska, and what happened was is that the family went to trial and the jury found that the doctor had committed negligence and awarded the family $5.65 million, which was enough money to take care of this child for the rest of his life. But because of a total cap in Omaha, Nebraska, which was $1.25 million at the time, the verdict was cut to $1.25 million. Then, of course, once the attorney's fees are taken out and medical bills are paid, Colin Gourley was left with just a few hundred thousand dollars, which was not even was so little to what he needed for the rest of his life. So who picks up the difference? You and I do, through our taxes, because he then goes on Medicaid. And then his bills still have to be paid. And so we wind up then in paying for these bills instead of the wrongdoer that the jury already found after a three-week trial that this person committed negligence and the person had insurance. Hmm. But because of the cap, the insurance, the amount was cut. And people think all the time, well, we're told that doctors' insurance rates are going up so high and doctors are leaving the area. And there's all this like myths. Again, these are part of the public relations campaign. When in fact, in most states where these tort reform measures or these caps are put in place, doctors' insurance rates don't go down. In fact, they go up at the same rate that all they go up in every other state, because these issues of how much money is being charged to for insurance rates have to do with the market and with they're cyclical in nature. And then people say, well, our healthcare costs are going up because of these big verdicts. Well, also baloney. In Texas, since 2003, you can't bring a medical malpractice case because of caps on damages and other issues there, and healthcare costs have gone up, not down.
Did this family open up right away to you?
You know, this particular family did, although I have to tell you a funny story about that. It was, again, their birthday. So I went, Colin, who's the boy who has the brain injury, I went to his class and filmed him and his class celebrating his birthday. But Connor, his identical twin brother, who was perfectly healthy, was supposed to have a birthday party that night. And we sent, because whenever you film people, you have to get a release. So we sent a little notice out to his friend's family saying, would you sign a release? We're going to film this. Do you know that not one of his friends' families allowed the kids to come to his birthday party? Because Omaha is very, very conservative, very, you know, big insurance. Insurance is like big in Omaha. And he didn't have his birthday party. I told him that he would be able to come as my guest to the Academy Awards when we get in there.
He must have liked that.
Well, he came to Sundance anyway.
The parents were so affecting in this as well. Colin and his brother, his twin brother, too. It was just a very moving segment of this film. And was it hard for you? How'd you feel about filming that?
Well, you know, because I was a trial lawyer and my background was in medical malpractice, it actually felt pretty comfortable for me. I mean, I knew that was the one thing about making this film is that I knew what questions to ask. I lived this. It's not like I was picking up a topic that I didn't know anything about. I mean, I lived this area of the law for 25 years. And so it was sort of innate in me. And I knew what questions I wanted to ask. And I knew what I wanted to show to the audience. So
on medical malpractice, Susan Teldoff, what do you tell people who say, you know, these doctors, they're saving a lot of people's lives. They're doing great work. Everyone's human. People make mistakes. You know, why take it out of their hide?
Yeah. So, of course, we all make mistakes. But the question is that when we make a mistake and we harm someone else, who should bear the brunt of that harm? Should the victim who wasn't involved in any way other than just, you know, going to a doctor and believing and trusting in the doctor and doing what the doctor says, or the doctor who makes the mistake? That's why we have insurance. That's why the doctor pays for insurance. Of course, we all make mistakes. But again, it's like, you know, and it's so interesting. Nobody ever thinks about these things or cares about it unless it affects you personally. And when it affects you personally or your family or your friend, who's the first person you go to? It's a lawyer. And what do you want? You want justice. But it's always like, oh, well, that other case is frivolous, or that person's trying to get something for nothing. It's never you.
Frivolous lawsuits, that's another one of the, you know, you got tort reform, frivolous lawsuits. These are the PR buzzwords that are just thrown out there. And Karl Rove has played a role, and he makes a cameo in your film. Explain what his role has been.
Well, Karl Rove came up with the idea that he wanted to come up with an issue that could galvanize money. You know, what issue will bring in money so if I'm in Texas and I'm trying to raise money for George Bush governor-elect or trying to become governor, how can I get money not just from Texas but from all over the country? Well, if I come up with an idea that limits corporate liability and I make that a centerpiece of my campaign, then I'm going to get money from all over the place. And he was smart enough to know that. And so tort reform not only became Governor Bush then's primary topic, but then when he became president, it became his number one issue. I mean, Rick Perry's doing the same thing right now in Texas. And so Karl Rove knew that. And so he really was the mastermind. And then if we're going to get to the next section of the film, which is on judicial elections, can we go on to that?
Sure.
So what happened was is that after these statutes were passed, these caps on damages statutes, they started to be challenged around the country because we have actually a constitutional amendment that says we have the right to trial by jury. It's called the Seventh Amendment to the Constitution. Nobody remembers that. They remember the Second Amendment. They remember the First Amendment, but they never remember the Seventh Amendment. Well, it's just as big as the others. I don't think that you give more weight to one versus the other. So the Seventh Amendment is trial by jury. And when you have these statutes that put caps, you are essentially taking away the constitutional right to have a trial by jury. So they were being challenged, these statutes, all over the country, because not just at the federal, at the state level, because many states have the same kind of constitutional amendment. And these statutes were being overturned. So Karl Rove also came up with this brilliant idea. Now, wait a second. We elect our judges in most of our states. Well, if we elect our judges, the judges have to run for office. And if they run for office, they have to raise money. So if we essentially figure out how to get our judge up on the state Supreme Court and put enough money in to defeat the other judge who's not pro-corporate enough, then we control our state Supreme Courts. And then when these statutes come up, we can upheld them. And when there are big plaintiff's verdicts, we can get them overturned. And so started in Texas, and then basically it went through the South, and then eventually, you know, came up, creeped up to the rest of the country. But essentially, judges in many of these states are being bought and paid for by the largest bidder, which is usually a large corporate entity.
It's happened right here in Wisconsin, too. And so in this section of the film, Susan Teldoff, and the film is Hot Coffee, and I highly recommend it, you focus on this judge in Mississippi, Judge Diaz. Briefly tell his story.
So if your listeners have ever read John Grisham's book, The Appeal, this will be familiar to them, because what we did is we documented the true life story that was fictionalized in that book, The Appeal, and John Grisham is actually in the film. He and Oliver Diaz were friends. John Grisham's from Mississippi. Oliver Diaz was a Mississippi State Supreme Court justice, and he was targeted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce because he wasn't pro-corporate enough. Now, most people get confused about the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They think it's either a government entity or they think it's sort of your local chamber at a bigger level. Well, wrong in both senses. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce is the largest lobbying group for corporations in the country, maybe even in the world. And they decided several years ago that they were going to start targeting judicial races, judge races, and they were going to put lots and lots of money from their member corporations and into these races. And they targeted Oliver Diaz because he wasn't pro-corporate enough. And they put up their candidate, and they put about $1 million into this little campaign in Mississippi, in Jackson, Mississippi. Anyway, even despite that and the false advertisements. Oh, by the way, you know, people watch television commercials around election time, and they see these organizations that are sponsoring these television commercials. Citizens for a Stronger Community, Citizens for a Safer Environment, whatever. Not knowing that there are no citizens in those groups. Those are organizations that are essentially front groups that are set up by large public relations firms, and no one knows who funds them. So these organizations oftentimes are funded by large corporate interests who are trying to either defeat an incumbent that they don't like or put someone in that they do like. And they did that with Oliver Diaz. And so they put all this money in, and lo and behold, he wins anyway. But after he wins, I don't know if you remember, but Alberto Gonzalez was the U.S. attorney back then, and he had that whole scandal about federal prosecutors who were bringing these false criminal charges against the largest Democratic contributors in the states. And so Oliver Diaz was charged falsely with bribery, that the largest Democratic contributor in Mississippi had loaned him money to compete with the U.S. Chamber's ads. He recused himself as a judge, which means he never sat on any case where this person or this person's law firm was involved. But despite that, they charged him with bribery. He spent 3 years fighting that charge, was completely acquitted, and then was brought up on false criminal charges for tax evasion like 3 days after that, completely acquitted. But because of that, he was off the bench for 3 years, and his reputation was completely tarnished, and he was unable to win. And after Oliver Diaz lost that election, the next election, the Mississippi Supreme Court did not uphold even one plaintiff's verdict in 2 years.
So that's how money just really distorts our judicial system. It's a story told by Susan Saldoff, my guest today, in her award-winning new documentary called Hot Coffee. That's the case of the woman at McDonald's who got burned terribly and sued McDonald's for damages, and that case was greatly distorted. There's one other case in here, and that's the Halliburton Jamie Lee Jones case. And this is a horrible human tragedy that you can go into briefly if you want. And then the issue is employees who sign away their rights when they sign up to work with the company or accept a job offer.
Yeah, so it's not just about employment contracts. The section of the film is about mandatory arbitration. And what most people don't realize, and this is sort of, okay, so back to my sort of the way that I constructed the film. So the last section of the film is what's happening today? What's happening to, you know, almost everybody in our society? Another sort of method of tort reform that's so insidious, people don't even know they're doing it, that they're signing away their rights. So in almost every contract that we have right now, and we're being asked to sign contracts every day, and sometimes we're not even asked to sign them. Just by using a product, we've agreed to certain conditions like your cell phone, your credit card, you know, your gym membership, your a mortgage, a real estate contract, your all of the things that we're – every time you buy anything online, you know, you have to like you have to check off the box and say, I agree, and there's all these like terms. Who reads those, right? And embedded in the fine print is something called mandatory arbitration or forced arbitration. And people go, okay, well, why should I care about that? It sounds very never going to happen to me, right? So you sign these things or you agree to them before you ever have a dispute with the company that you're buying this product from or doing something with. And then you have a dispute. What have you done? Well, the company that you now have this dispute with, they pick the decision maker, they pay for the decision maker. The decision maker doesn't have to come up with a reason why he or she comes up with the decision. It's completely secretive and there's no right to appeal. Now, who would assign that voluntarily if you actually knew that? Because the decision makers have an incentive to rule for the company that's paying them because they want to get picked again. Whereas the consumer, hopefully will only have this one dispute ever. They're not like a repeat person to them. So over 90% of the time, the consumer loses and the company wins. And we are signing these away all the time, and people don't understand that they're doing it.
And the amazing stat there in the film that I saw was that more than one out of every three American workers sign one of these things with their employers.
One of the a funny story, when we were accepted as one of 16 films into the U.S. documentary competition at Sundance, and there were, I think, like 842 entries for that section that year. And when I got the call from one of the programmers, he said, "Susan, we just were so thrilled that you got into this film festival." And of course, I'm screaming and yelling because this is my first film. I mean, it's amazing. And he says, "But you do know that everyone in the office is checking their employment contracts to see if they have a mandatory arbitration clause." And he said, "And we do." And I said, "Well, the ironic part is that I had to sign one to enter this festival."
Oh, really?
And I didn't want to, but I didn't. Like, one of my producers said, "Just sign it. You know, you don't have a choice. You can't get it. You know, you cannot get an AT&T phone right now unless you you don't even sign anything. They say to activate your phone, you need to press 1. But before activating your phone, please know that you're subject to a mandatory arbitration clause. Then you have to activate your phone. It's like, otherwise you don't have a phone."
So we're just signing our rights away here.
Right. We're voluntarily doing it.
You obviously want people to do something, get some message out of this film. For people who see the film, for people who've been listening to this show, Progressive Radio, I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. My guest, Susan Saldoff, her movie Hot Coffee. What do you want them to do?
Yeah.
What can they do?
So most people who see this film get really angry afterwards. They want to do something because they feel really, like, duped. And so we have a section on our webpage. Our webpage is hotcoffeethemovie.com, and we have a section called Take Action. And it has all the different ways that you can take action on these issues of the public relations campaign, caps on damages, judicial elections, and mandatory arbitration. We also have a what you can do list, so that if people want to do something to get this film out further. But primarily, we want people to be educated consumers. When you hear these ridiculous stories about, oh, did you hear the one about the guy who's on the RV and he puts it in cruise control and he goes back to make a cup of coffee and he gets in an accident, you know, crazy stuff like that. If it sounds crazy, it's probably not true. It was probably made up by somebody to make you think that there are all these crazy lawsuits. You know, caps on damages, I say oppose caps on damages. Contact your legislators. Tell them we don't need a one-size-fits-all a cap. We need to have access to the courts. Judicial elections, try to find out who's behind these campaigned ads. Try to find out a little bit more about who these candidates are and who's backing them. And then in terms of mandatory arbitration, there is something pending, a bill pending in both the House and the Senate right now called the Arbitration Fairness Act. Please contact your state legislators and your senators and tell them to support that. And then if you want to buy a copy of Hot Coffee, the movie, Hot Coffee, and show it to your family and friends, have a house party. Go to our website. The DVDs become available November 1st. You can order them now and also put them on your Netflix queue so that you can get one and if you don't want to buy one.
The website again is hotcoffeethemovie.com. My guest has been Susan Saldoff, the producer and director of this incredible movie, Hot Coffee. Susan, great movie. I watched it and was very angry while I was watching it and shocked, too.
Thanks so much
for being my guest.
Thanks so much for letting me come on.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.